From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, following the sudden death of Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, we examine the growing nationwide threat posed by heroin.
The death of Philip Seymour Hoffman is a huge tragedy. It's also a wake-up call.
We hear from South Africa as the details of Nelson Mandela's will are made public. And a week of protest ahead after the US State Department releases its final environmental impact report of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline.
Allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest, and our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The first ever report on corruption in the European Union has revealed the problem costs the EU economy around 120 billion euros per year. The European Commissioner for Home Affairs, Cecilia Malmström, whose office compiled the report, has called the results breathtaking. Europe correspondent Jack Perrock reports.
The European Commissioner for Home Affairs, Cecilia Malmström, has presented a report which looks at corruption across the 28 EU member states. She says the problem's costing the EU economy about 120 billion euro per year, which she says is a conservative figure because they aren't able to measure the corruption which goes on under the radar. The report, which is intentionally not put in a system of ranking countries, focuses on three key issues: corruption in matters of public procurement, which it says is widespread, funding of political parties, and corruption within local governments.
Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych is returning to work after 4 days off sick. Protesters, who have braved temperatures lower than minus 20 Celsius since November, are still demanding he leave office. Meanwhile, Yanukovych's temporary government has bowed to domestic and international pressure and released an opposition activist for treatment after he was reportedly tortured. Tom Barton has more.
The return of embattled President Viktor Yanukovych has raised suspicion as to whether he will continue hesitant moves towards compromise or try and crack down on his opponents. The European Union and United States are putting pressure on him to compromise after the resignation of his Prime Minister and a proposed conditional amnesty failed to appease protesters. Russia's government, meanwhile, whose pressure forced Mr. Yanukovych away from a deal with the EU and started the crisis, says it will hold back desperately needed loan money until a new government is chosen. Opposition activist Dmitry Bulatov, who has spoken of being abducted and tortured by men with Russian accents, has had charges of inciting mass disorder lifted under Western diplomatic pressure and is flying to Lithuania for treatment.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has revealed he hasn't spoken to U.S. President Barack Obama since June. The Afghan leader revealed the extent of his rift with his U.S. counterpart in an interview to Britain's Sunday Times newspaper, in which he blasts the Obama administration for failing to listen to him. But politicians in Washington have lost patience with Mr. Karzai at a crucial moment in the country's future, as Nina Maria Potts reports.
Hamid Karzai has grown increasingly angry at the U.S. administration as Afghanistan gears up for new presidential elections in April. Mr. Karzai has reached the end of his term and is prohibited from running again, but he appears determined to expose the gulf between his government and U.S. President Barack Obama, even as he leaves office. He told Britain's Sunday Times newspaper that he spent the last 12 years trying to get Washington to listen to him.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. media is reporting that police investigators have found nearly 50 envelopes containing a substance they believe to be heroin in Philip Seymour Hoffman's apartment. The 46-year-old actor was found dead with a needle in his arm in his apartment in New York City. Abortion rates in the U.S. have dropped to their lowest levels since 1973, according to a new report. The study's lead author attributes the decrease in abortions to improved contraceptive use. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry feels that it is time for a new policy on Syria, according to top congressional officials briefed by America's top diplomat. The remarks were made following the Munich Security Conference, where U.N. Special Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi reported no progress at the Geneva II talks. Priscilla Huff has more.
Following the Munich Security Conference, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry briefed the bipartisan congressional delegation in Germany, telling them due to recent developments on the ground in Syria, it is time to change strategy, or at the very least, explore a broader range of policy options. The top lawmakers pushed back, noting there is little support inside America for a deeper involvement in Syria. But according to the senators who then briefed reporters, the White House is very aware Russia continues to supply arms to the Assad regime and that Bashar al-Assad is slow-walking the removal of chemical weapons from Syria. And most of all, there is a growing threat from al-Qaeda.
And the remnants of the late Colonel Gaddafi's chemical arsenal have been quietly disposed of in a program backed by the U.S., according to a report in the New York Times. The paper says the effort was carried out in secret, driven by concern that the weapons could get into the hands of terrorists. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The actor Philip Seymour Hoffman was found dead on Sunday following a suspected drug overdose. His long battle with drug addiction has been well documented. Police reported the 46-year-old Oscar-winning actor was discovered in his New York apartment with a hypodermic needle still in his arm. The results of an autopsy have yet to be released. For the latest on the story, I spoke to our New York correspondent, Ira Spitzer.
Yes, well, everything seems to point to a heroin overdose at this point. Of course, we'll have to wait for the toxicology reports to be sure of exactly what caused his death. But, of course, he was found with a needle in his arm with some empty bags of what appeared to be heroin near his body. And also, media outlets are now reporting that the police have said they found about 50 envelopes of what appears to be heroin in his apartment. This is called the Ace of Spades, which is a street name for heroin. He also had a envelopes with the name Ace of Hearts, which is another strain of heroin. So a very sad story. Hoffman, of course, a great actor, won an Oscar in 2005 for his role in the movie Capote, a very memorable character actor. Many consider him one of the greatest, if not the greatest actor of his generation. He has struggled with on and off with drugs and alcohol. He went to rehab last year for an addiction to heroin as well as prescription painkillers. He also, right at the age of 22, did a stint in rehab as well. But it seemed like he was, according to many sources, clean for a large portion of his career. So he seems to have really relapsed, in the last week leading up to his death, with these multiple bags of heroin found in his apartment. And just a very sad story for, someone who, had many great years ahead of him, 46 years old, very young. So we've really seen an outpouring of support both among his peers and just among the public in general. It's a very sad day for a lot of people.
As you mentioned, several theories swirling around the actor's death. But the autopsy, is that the results of that are expected today?
Yeah, the autopsy will happen today. And the toxicology report, which will come from the autopsy, that'll take a few weeks to determine the exact cause of death. So the autopsy is scheduled to happen today, but we'll have to wait a little longer to see if it was heroin that he had in his system.
We've read reports of authorities painting a quite a grim picture of the scenes that they were greeted with of the actor surrounded by drugs, what seemed to be drugs paraphernalia, and indeed a hypodermic needle hanging from his arm.
Yeah, the scene as described, really points to a very dark, final hours of his life. I mean, not only the empty bags found, but now the new development, of 50 envelopes of heroin found in his apartment. We don't know what was going on in his life to stock up on such a dangerous drug like that. And also, considering his past struggles, what amounts to a very severe relapse. But an awful scene at the apartment as police and witnesses have described it.
Ira Spitzer in New York. Drug addiction is also a dominant issue for the governor of Vermont, Peter Shumlin. Last month, he devoted his entire State of the State address to what he described as Vermont's full-blown heroin crisis.
It requires all of us to take action before the quality of life that we cherish so much is compromised.
Earlier, I spoke to filmmaker Bess O'Brien, whose documentary, The Hungry Heart, tackles prescription drug addiction in the state.
Well, I think the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman is a huge tragedy. It's also a wake-up call, because what we know about drug addiction is that it cuts across all classes and all economic levels and all different kinds of lifestyles, and it is not just about some junkie on the wrong side of the track sitting, you know, begging for food on the sidewalk or breaking into your house. And I think that in making my documentary film, The Hungry Heart, here in Vermont, that is really what we focused on, is looking at the fact that prescription drug addiction, opiate addiction, heroin addiction, which is definitely a huge epidemic across the United States, anywhere and everywhere, including in Hollywood, New York City, and in the smallest town in Vermont, cuts across all kinds of different lifestyles, backgrounds, and people. And it is a disease, and it is a disease that when it takes a hold of you, it doesn't let you go. And in order to get clean, it takes a huge amount of personal work, integrity, and focus to tackle this beast. It is, it's not like, well, I'm a celebrity, therefore, if I have an addiction, I can just fix it because I can afford to go to the best clinic or get the best treatment. That certainly helps, but obviously, this is a disease that when it consumes you, it takes over. And, you know, it is a disease that affects everyone, our neighbors, our friends, our family, our coworkers.
We should, just for those who aren't aware of what happened in January, this is the governor of Vermont, Peter Shumlin, who devoted his entire State of the State address to the issue of heroin addiction and prescription drug addiction and what it was doing to his state. And during that address, he actually highlighted your documentary, The Hungry Heart, which covers the same issue, and suggested it should be rolled out across schools as a means of educating people on the issue.
Yes, and you know, before the governor's speech this January, we had toured the Hungry Heart film across Vermont to 34 towns, small towns, cities, played it at town halls, church basements, theaters, you name it, and over 8,000 people saw the film in Vermont, and it created a real conversation between communities about this very real issue that hits so many people. So, you know, it was great to see the governor watch the film, be moved by the film, and understand the human stories that lie behind addiction, and realize that those are the people that we need to help and focus on. We don't need to be putting more people in jail. That doesn't work. We need to be getting people into treatment.
Filmmaker Bess O'Brien. This is FSN Reports. The U.S. State Department has released its final environmental impact assessment of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, which would pump tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Gulf Coast. The move has strong opposition, with hundreds of protests planned this week across Canada and the U.S., including in front of the White House on Monday, aimed at convincing President Obama to reject the pipeline's permit. For more on this, in Washington, Alice Olstein has the story.
A private contractor named Environmental Resources Management told the State Department that the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline is unlikely to significantly impact how much of Canada's tar sands reserves are dug up and burned, and how much heavy crude is refined on the Gulf Coast of Texas. but the State Department did acknowledge Monday that tar sands oil is 17% more carbon intensive than regular oil. Quoting from a speech the president gave last summer, White House spokesperson Jay Carney told reporters Monday that this would be a major factor in whether the project is ultimately approved.
Allowing the Keystone Pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest, and our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
Though environmental groups praised the report for at least considering the pipeline's contribution to climate change, some experts, including Kate Colarulli with the Sierra Club, said they didn't go far enough. Colarulli said the report violates the National Environmental Protection Act by not considering all of the impacts of the project, especially those at the site in Alberta, Canada, where forests are clear-cut and tar sands are mined from the ground.
It's so large, you can see it from space. There's these toxic sludge ponds that just are oozing mercury and arsenic. The local populations are seeing these insane rises of rare cancers. The Act says you have to look at all of that stuff up there, and then you have to look at what's at the bottom. And what the State Department's report does is it just looks at the pipeline. So it doesn't take into consequence like the entire scheme of things.
Colarulli called these omissions disappointing, but said they pale in comparison to the ethical issues surrounding the group that wrote the report. Though the State Department said Friday that they are very confident that the company Environmental Resources Management has no conflicts of interest, documents obtained by the Sierra Club through Freedom of Information Act requests paint a different picture. ERM is a dues-paying member of the American Petroleum Institute, which has spent millions of dollars lobbying for the approval of Keystone XL. They also have significant business ties with TransCanada, the company that would build and own the pipeline, but did not disclose those ties on its application.
The contractor who wrote this report is essentially in bed with the oil industry. They consider themselves part of the oil industry, so much so that they're paying dues to be part of the lobbying association of the oil industry. And so you start to wonder if maybe the whole process has been biased.
The Inspector General is currently investigating these reported conflicts of interest, but the State Department said that investigation is on a completely different track from the one that decides the fate of the pipeline. On Monday night, in hundreds of cities across the U.S. and Canada, Native groups and U.S. activists will be demonstrating against Keystone XL. In D.C., environmentalists will hold a vigil in front of the White House. In Houston, Texas, residents who have already been affected by the massive oil refineries in their neighborhood will share their stories. And as they participate in similar demonstrations this week, Ogallala Lakota member Deborah Whiteplume says she and many other Indigenous activists are preparing to go much further if construction on the pipeline goes forward.
You put your body in front of those earth movers, you put your body in front of corporations. They're going to have to be run over, or they're going to have to be put in jail if America wants TransCanada to have its way.
This Wednesday, the State Department will begin a 30-day public comment period on the environmental report, and federal agencies such as the Environmental Protection Agency will have 90 days to weigh in. Whenever the State Department does announce its final decision, other agencies will have 15 days to object, and if just one does, the president must decide whether or not to issue the permit.
He can change the world with one word, and that word is no. No to TransCanada.
The White House has so far refused to say which way President Obama is leaning on the issue. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, here in Washington, D.C., Janet Yellen has been sworn in as the first woman to lead the U.S. Federal Reserve in its 100-year history. Dr. Yellen was confirmed by the Senate last month and sworn in this Monday morning, but she takes over as the Fed has decided to continue reducing the pace of quantitative easing by $10 billion a month. Choppy waters to negotiate for the new chair, as Lorna Shaddick explains.
Janet Yellen is qualified to take the helm of the Fed and make history by becoming the first woman to run the central bank.
That was Sherrod Brown, a Democratic senator from Ohio, speaking at Janet Yellen's confirmation hearing back in early January. Dr. Yellen takes on the post during a tumultuous time for the U.S. economy, as Joe Minerick at the Committee for Economic Development and a former colleague of Yellen's explains.
The difficulty that she's going to face is unwinding what is an extraordinary degree of monetary stimulus, including the quantitative easing program, which is unprecedented. So for that reason, every step that she takes in unwinding that stimulus is going to be a matter for uncertainty in the markets.
That monetary stimulus is, of course, the Fed's policy of injecting more cash into the U.S. economy as part of helping the recovery from the financial crisis. But it needs to be communicated with care. Back in June, markets had difficulty understanding Ben Bernanke's comments on when and how the Fed would start tapering off that support, sending stocks tanking and interest rates spiking. In December, the Federal Open Market Committee carefully laid out its plan to gradually unwind the bond purchasing program, and it's also pledged to keep interest rates low until the recovery takes hold. But it'll be Janet Yellen's job to oversee that process and make sure it works. Joe Minerick again.
She's going to have to give the markets a sense of confidence that the economy is strong enough to withstand the withdrawal of the stimulus that the Fed has provided. And that's going to be a very, very difficult thing to do.
It may be a big ask, but Dr. Yellen has some formidable qualifications and experience on her side. The 67-year-old with an economics PhD from Yale taught at Harvard, the London School of Economics and the University of California before eventually running the Federal Reserve of San Francisco, then becoming Ben Bernanke's number two. That experience as his right-hand woman should serve her well, says Joseph Gagnon from Washington's Peterson Institute for Economics.
This is probably the smoothest transition in Fed history in terms of the new chairman having a similar outlook and sensibilities to the old chairman. I think she thinks of the world the same way he does.
Janet Yellen's got a difficult balancing act to undertake as she gets her feet under the table, carefully managing a return to more normal monetary policy at a time when the US economy is still shakily recovering, and also fighting off hostile Republicans in the House who want to rein in just how much the Fed can do. But with a track record of calm decision-making and a similarity to her predecessor's style and views, this looks set to be a smooth transition to a safe pair of hands. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. The details of Nelson Mandela's will have been made public following his death in December. The former South African president's $4.1 million estate will be shared among family, staff and the ruling African National Congress. The announcement came shortly before the collapse of a significant political merger that was expected to offer a strong challenge to the ANC. For more on these matters, I spoke to the Daily Telegraph's Southern Africa correspondent, Ashlyn Lang.
So this was a public announcement of Nelson Mandela's will, which I don't think anyone really expected, but the executors of the will said that they were really keen the process should be as transparent as possible. Obviously, there has been a lot of controversy surrounding Nelson Mandela's legacy and particularly his financial legacy. His family have previously taken close friends of his to court for control of trusts that hold his money. So it is quite a contentious issue, and I think everybody was a bit nervous about how this might play out. Nelson Mandela's three remaining children, all women, did not receive anything in his will because they have already apparently received $300,000 roughly each as a sort of advance inheritance. Because they haven't paid that back, they now receive nothing further from the will. However, most of the grandchildren get between $300,000 and maybe about $10,000 inheritance cash. And the most notable things really are that Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who was Nelson Mandela's wife for 30 years and more than 30 years, and obviously appears prominently in the film Long Walk to Freedom, which was released recently, receives absolutely nothing at all, while former schools that he attended and people who used to work for him, including his driver and his cook, received quite generous handouts of about $10,000 or $5,000.
Perhaps not the last we'll hear of matters concerning Nelson Mandela's will and estate. But if I could just ask you about another story that's been dominating headlines in South Africa, and that's the collapse of a significant political merger.
Yeah, so when this was announced last Tuesday, there was great excitement and many people saying this really could be a game changer for South African politics. The African National Congress has been in power for 20 years now, ever since Nelson Mandela led the country out of apartheid, and it still has two-thirds of the voter share. However, the formation of this sort of merger with the biggest opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, and one of South Africa's most respected sort of veteran anti-apartheid campaigners was really, it prompted quite a bit of excitement and a sense from many that perhaps the political landscape might be changing a little bit. Unfortunately, it all seemed to unravel pretty quickly. It seemed that Dr. Mampela Ramphele, that noted anti-apartheid activist, hadn't really consulted the members of her own party, which she intended to merge with the Democratic Alliance. They reacted pretty strongly against it. And as a result, she tried to sort of bring about a halfway house compromise, which involved her remaining leader of her party, but also standing as the DA's presidential candidate. In the end, the DA said, you know what, this just isn't going to work, and they had to call time on it. So a bit of a disappointment, really, for both parties and for South Africans who really felt that this might be a viable alternative to the ANC.
The Daily Telegraph's Southern Africa correspondent Ashlyn Lang. A castaway fisherman who's been rescued in the Marshall Islands after spending more than a year adrift at sea says he just wants to go back to Mexico. 37-year-old Jose Salvador Albarengo, originally from El Salvador, is now in the Marshall Islands capital undergoing medical examinations. Albarengo claims he left Mexico in December 2012 on a fishing trip with a friend who later died at sea. It's reported he survived the 8,000-kilometre journey by catching fish, birds and turtles. Our correspondent Rebecca Hume spoke to oceanography professor Norman Guineos from Texas A&M University.
So essentially, the currents in the Pacific form sort of one big gyre that goes around from, you know, all over to from up from Japan. There's the Kuroshio Current that's sort of like our Gulf Stream. And there's a flow across the North Atlantic, and it comes down along California and goes back, circulates back around toward the west, and so he could pick up the North Equatorial Current off of Mexico, and he could drift very long way on that. If the currents are say going 20 centimeters a second, which is sort of a mild current, that's 17 kilometers a day. In 6 months, you can go a long way.
Now, it says in media, they're talking about how he survived, which is also a big talking point, because the photographs are showing that he actually looks quite well, considering, you know, he's been alone at sea. He does explain that he had someone with him who died quite soon into the voyage. And he's saying that he survived on birds, turtles and fish that he caught with his bare hands. Now, could you tell us something about, you know, the conditions in the Pacific? I mean, is this kind of survival possible?
I think it is. A smart person could figure that out, and I think a person could survive in a small boat. The hardest thing is keeping out of the sun. I think he looks pretty well for being exposed to the elements. People make long ocean journeys all the time and survive by catching fish and birds. I just finished reading a book by Tim Severin, who sailed a leather boat from Ireland to Newfoundland back in the 70s. And he and his crew survived by catching fish and eating, what they caught. I think he probably had a better chance of dying out there than he did living, but I think he lived. I mean, the other alternative is there's some story behind this that they'd have to try to figure out why he did it.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can tell us what you think of our program by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. Join us tomorrow for more national and international coverage. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.